Welcome back to the show. My guest this hour is David Elkington, and we're talking about an update on the Jordan Codices. Experts say this 2,000-year-old lead tablets containing a portrait of what they believe to be Jesus found in a remote cave are genuine. And we're talking about this, an actual portrait of Jesus. How rare is that, David, to see something that dates back that far and have an image that is relatable to the Christ?
Rare as it gets, actually. We've assessed it, and in my own opinion, not everybody agrees that it is him, but I think that if you look at the image, it's very small. The face is encapsulated in a halo, and given that it's on a sealed book, and when you read the Book of Revelation, you have to think to yourself, well, this has got to be the same book. The descriptions seem to meet. They seem to be quite approximate, and it's remarkable stuff, because in Revelation Christ says he will come again, and here we are in 2016, and that's precisely what's happened. We've got this extraordinary image, and it's just been found in a cave after 2,000 years, and Christ is back. He's here. It's great. It's good news.
When you look at images that are represented through these tablets, how clear are others? Can you look at it and know that this is a representation of, whatever they're trying to put through? Or because the picture is very crude and it's very hard to see on a scan from the photographs that we can see. But I'm sure in person it's got a much more impressive look to it. But how exactly definable are the other images throughout the codices?
Oh, they're very, very, very definable indeed. I mean, the image that I took of the face, I had literally a few seconds to take the photograph. I was in the house of Hassan Saida, who's the guardian of the codices that he has brought over the border from Jordan and keeps them in his house in Israel. And I have to say, he's been a very, very noble guardian of them. He too is equally fascinated by what they are and what they represent. But the central codex, quite rightfully, he's very, very jealous about. He guards it with his life, and I can't blame him. So I had a very brief period of time in increasingly bad light to take the photograph, but it's a good enough photograph to get a good definition, a good sense that what we have here is the classic Nazarene face with the two-pronged beard, the long hair, and this face that shines out with its eyes and this kind of image of the man of woes, I guess. And in a sense, it's not as highly defined as later Christian art. But then you can't expect it to be. This is something that's been buried in a cave for 2,000 years and
right.
covered with limescale and detritus and has been subject to all manner of indignities. And here it is. It survived. At least it survived. And it's great to see it there. And for me personally, I think that it's a very, very holy artifact, because it's the last, as it were, footprint of a very, very great man who achieved things that every human being would like to achieve in themselves, at the culmination of their lives. And I think that to see him back makes us reflect more upon his message, no matter what religion you are, no matter what persuasion you are. This is a man who reached the point of enlightenment and came down from that to share that knowledge. And I think that's a very remarkable thing.
It's interesting the way you brought up how the art is represented, and though it's somewhat crude, I know I for a long time dealt in antiquities with gold and silver coins, and especially the biblical times, the coins from that era are very fascinating. The imagery and artwork on them are in some cases extremely beautiful and detailed, and in some cases very rudimentary. And one of the things that we came into possession of through the before they started doing this embargo and shutting down allowing a lot of the antiquities out of Jerusalem was this really interesting old cross. I think it was a Byzantine cross, and the image of Christ represented on it looks like a gray alien. It is one of the most fascinating images, and there's no other way to describe what you're looking at other than it's got this bulbous head with the two kind of strange teardrop eyes. And the way it is represented on there is not even a beard. It is just one of the weirdest points. But again, they did what they could do with the tools of the time and what was available to them. We've got to take a quick break again. We'll open up phone lines here at the bottom of the hour. David Elkington, our guest for the remainder of this hour. And then remember, in the last 2 hours of the show, we're going on the hunt for the lost Ark of the Covenant. We'll do that right here on Coast to Coast AM. And we're back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, sitting in for George Norrie. And tonight we are talking about the updates on the Jordan codices and talking with the expert, David Elkington, about this. Let's take a look at the actual content of these codices and what it represents to the Christian faith, why these might be suppressed, and is there something so startling that's in this that people want to keep it suppressed? David, why? Can you give us any insights on that?
I think the general point here is that when people, particularly the bloggers, condemned this discovery as being fake and all the rest of it, they were very careless. They didn't. We never received a single request for data or information about what they could represent before they went on the attack. Mm-hmm. So it's quite an interesting illustration of how defensive people get. And I think that, you know, if we look at this overall, you know, Christianity is in decline all over the world. And regardless of what people might say, the official figures from all the churches are pretty, you know, bad reading, actually, with a few exceptions. The overall impact of the books, I think, and particularly with the face of Jesus having been found, I think is going to lead to a proper and more open debate about Christianity. And I think it's going to lead people back to the church, personally. I wouldn't see this as a danger to my faith. And if it was, then what I would say is that my faith wasn't very strong in the first place. You know, we've got a great opportunity here to reassess Christian origins, to find confirmatory evidence of what the Gospels tell us, and to actually look at Jesus anew. You know, Revelation said he would come back in the form of a book, and this is precisely what's happened. And now I think we need to kind of look at the times in which we live and say why. And I think that.
Well, now when you say that he's. You say that he promised to return in a book. I think a lot of people understood it a different way, that when Christ returns, it will be like a thief in the night at first, and that will be his first kind of reappearance, and then his reemergence will be in the final holy war. And again, if I'm misunderstanding, it's been quite a few years since I was a Lutheran grade school boy, so, you know, you can help redirect me on that. But
I love the description of a thief in the night, because that's right. Almost precisely a description of the books being found in the cave by the Bedouin. But in terms of him coming back in the final holy war, a lot of scholars believe that to be the fall of Jerusalem in the years 66 to 70 AD, after the first great revolt against Roman occupation. And it could well be that, you know, the idea of Jesus returning in the future, well, in what form? Remember what I said at the beginning of the interview, the Jews and the Christians are a very logical people, and they therefore, you know, believed in rational argument. And therefore, if you're going to actually return in the future and you want to, embody your presence as such, what's the best way to do it? I'd have thought that in book form would have been quite the best way.
Could be, right. I mean, that might be the best way. You know, I know that there's been a lot of thought that, with the possible rise of the Antichrist and the Christ, that the one way that he will be seen around the world all at once is, you know, with every smartphone, tablet, TV, everything. If they were to make their appearance now, it would be so easy to transmit their image and be seen worldwide in an instant, much like the prophecies kind of laid out. Now, I know that a lot of the naysayers haven't even had a chance to look at it. Has much been done and translated from what was said in these books? And is there anything that you would see would be considered highly controversial to the current understanding of the Christian faith?
I think the books, obviously the translation goes on. I think the books offer us quite a few insights. And yes, there will be a few differences, but in terms of what the books seem to suggest, my own interpretation would be that if we look at the way in which they are laid out in terms of both illustrations and script, it would appear to me that We have, for instance, on many of them, a menorah. It's a seven-branch menorah. Now, the menorah itself is a part of the temple furniture. It was forbidden to be represented in its day by any other people in any other way. It couldn't, you know, such a thing was blasphemous. But here it is, all over the books. The piece of God's furniture from God's room in the temple, the Holy of Holies. And underneath it, we have in Paleo-Hebrew text the words Yelek Beitum, which basically means I shall walk uprightly, or I shall walk in righteousness. What does that mean? It's upon inquiry and having discussed this with other scholars who are real experts in this, they agree that it's most likely a resurrection text. And therefore, it would seem that perhaps the resurrection came, as it were, before the crucifixion, which is what the Gnostic Gospel of Philip seems to state, that you have to be resurrect before you go to death. In other words, you have to be self-aware, you have to be fully conscious. And that way, when you get to the other side, you know, you are awake. You are awake to the power of God. Now, I might be wrong, but I would suggest that the codices are telling us precisely that, that, you know, Jesus was fully aware, fully awake when he walked into that Holy of Holies, which I believe is the episode that comes directly after the money changers episode in the Gospels, and that he himself became resurrect in the sight of God.
Do you believe that from what you're finding in these codices and some of the translations and ideology of it, that Jesus wanted to create kind of a newer religious movement at the time, and something different than what we currently know as modern-day Christianity?
Well, what's curious, in the Dead Sea Scroll literature, we now know that the Essenes, or Nazareans, as they are called, we know that they wrote at least a part of the Dead Sea Scroll literature, if not all of it, but they held the Second Temple, the Temple of King Herod, to be very polluted and very, very corrupt. And it seems that their aim was to actually restore the rituals and liturgies of the old temple, the Temple of Solomon. Now, if we look at the Christian texts, the liturgies, the rites, you look at even at Christian architecture, the beautiful Gothic cathedrals, references made all over them to King Solomon, to Solomon's temple. And if you look at what Jesus is saying, there's absolutely no doubt about it. He was seeking to restore that which had been lost. So, did he want to create a new religion? I don't think so. Did he want to restore an older version of his faith? I think that's very much the case. And I think he succeeded, because obviously Christianity took root. But then, of course, immediately in the years after Jesus' passing, it then was hijacked by other political concerns, and namely the Roman Empire.
So many hands in this mixture, so many voices and points of view, that it's alarming that we're, you know, that we even have something that's still contextually important, because there have been so many people that have partaken in retelling or reshaping this history, it seems.
It's all too often the case, isn't it? I mean, you know, spin doctors don't just exist in the 21st century, I'm afraid to say. We get them right throughout history. And that's why when we look at some of the translations of the codices made thus far, you know, we have to kind of look at them with new eyes. I mean, we have one statement here: the humble of the flock, they shall be saved. Those who seek the Lord with a whole heart. You know, we've got a reference here to Christ and the real meaning of Christianity, and we've now got to work out what was that meaning, given that most of the texts that we've got in translated form have been edited or reshaped towards new audiences. You know, I mean, I saw a few years ago that they've just written the Bible in a kind of new rap speak. You know. It's very amusing, I have to say, but not something I understand. But you can see that having been written in terms of rap language, it's so far removed from the original Aramaic and Greek languages that, of course, the subtleties get lost in translation, and the poetry goes. So you kind of find yourself much more distant from the original Christians and the way in which they spread their extraordinary message.
Fascinating aspects of all of this history. I'm glad you're here to share this with us. And again, we're going to open up phone lines here in a few moments. So if you'd like to call in and you have questions for our guest, you can certainly be a part of the show. We'll run those phone numbers for you here during the break. And we'd love for you to join us, chat, ask questions. You can email me, dave@darknessradio.com, dave@darknessradio.com. Bruce did. He said, thanks for the great show tonight. How many pages do these books contain, and how are they being held together? And that actually comes from Susan. I'm sorry.
That's a really great question, actually. A lot of the books have, around about 6 or 7 pages or lead plates each. When the lead's been molded, it's been poured out onto a bed, and it takes a uniform thickness. They've then been cut out, and they've been bound with metal rings or lead rings, which we think have been actually hardened with charcoal over a fire and then squeezed through apertures in order to actually give you that sort of tightness. And when we've sometimes opened those rings, they've literally fallen apart into crumbs. It's quite remarkable. But there are other books as well that have many pages, multiple pages. I mean, over 20 or 30, and they are equally remarkable.
One of our listeners, Michael, says, metallurgy, thankfully, a specific period such as the Bronze Age codices can be verified based on the spread of metal processing knowledge and literacy. And he asked, what is the sheet uniformity? Is that something that you're familiar with?
No, I'm not. I'd have to ask the metal experts on that. But if he goes to the Jordan Codices Facebook page and asks the question there, I'll see that it's answered properly by one of our experts and get that information to him as soon as possible.
Righty. He wraps up with saying, the Old Testament may also be later material. Remember, the Bible was written over many years when Jesus was alive. He only had the first 5 books in a scroll form. As Jesus and the apostles traveled, people would document his messages, and text variations would be expected. And that comes from Michael in Milwaukee, which is some really great insight on this as well. So you are
right.
Right. Yeah, you're going to find some of these differences.
Good observation. But what it does show you as well is that the Old Testament and the New Testament were very, very much interlinked in that way. And therefore, one did not necessarily emerge from the other. They both emerged from an equal source at around about the same time. And I would suggest that source is older traditions of Hebraism dating back to the time of Solomon.
All right. We've got open phone lines going to come up here in a little bit, as I said, and I'm working through if emails have come in and people are looking for questions regarding this topic. You can certainly be a part of the show and do that with us. We've also got links up to our guest and his information so you can follow along for yourself and learn more about the Jordan Codices and follow along there. I also want to make a quick mention as we're going into break here. The holidays are right around the corner. George wants me to remind you that you don't have to be alone anymore. You've got Christmas coming. You've got New Year's following and Valentine's Day right around the corner. It's about time you find somebody special, whether it's your new best friend or the love of your life. ParanormalDate.com is open and running, around 50,000 members strong, and it's your opportunity to go in and meet somebody that has interests like you. If you enjoy the topics you hear on Coast to Coast AM, then you're going to love the opportunity to meet people like you, like-minded, open-minded, and interested in all of the mysteries that life has to offer. So you can go in, it's free to join, and then if you decide you'd like to stay, you can certainly do that with a full membership and get full access. All the information's at the site ParanormalDate.com. And if you like what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, don't forget Beyond Belief, George's TV show. You can see what you hear on Coast to Coast even more in depth with fantastic guests, great visualizations, so much information that you're going to want to sign up and get more. Go check out beyondbelief.com and give yourself the opportunity to see the other great work that George Norrie is doing along with this. And I do want to remind you, there's a really cool gift item out there right now. If you haven't already stumbled upon it, George Norrie has authored a brand new book, Night Talk. And it's available on Amazon.com, and I have it under good authority. If you go order it right now, you should have it in plenty of time for the holidays. It'll make a fantastic stocking stuffer for those you love. We'll be back. We've got more to discuss, and we'll be taking your calls. I'm Dave Schrader. This is Coast to Coast AM. Thank you for joining me here this evening. Remember, at the top of the hour, we're going to be talking about the Lost Ark of the Covenant. Has it been found? Where is it? Our guest, Graham Phillips, believes he has the information. I appreciate all the amazing emails I'm getting about where the location of the Ark is, but let's let our guest shine tonight since, you know, we went to the difficulty of getting him online. He's getting up early from England to tell us his story. We should at least let him have his chance. And then I'll make sure to ask him about all the other aspects and places that you believe the Ark of the Covenant is. I've been told that it might be buried right next to Jimmy Hoffa. So there's that possibility. Right now, though, we're talking with David Elkington, and we're talking about the Jordan Codices. You know, I got a couple of fascinating emails. This one really was interesting to me. Chris wrote in. He says, great show. My question is, who made these books? Not what people, but rather who specifically, and how do we know that these weren't made by a radical group of sorts? I mean, if you take someone like Jim Jones or David Koresh and place them back in that time, do you think we would hold them up in as high as regard as Jesus? How do we really know that this just wasn't a cult of their time that was writing or rewriting history? And that's a fascinating aspect I hadn't even thought of before. What do you make of that, David?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And it's a very relevant and salient one, too. I would suggest that the group that made the codices, well, first of all, metal workers were craftsmen, and the thing about craftsmen was that in Greek they were described as tekton, which is exactly how Jesus is described in the Bible. The effort and the time taken to make these things and then to seal them, and not only seal them, but seal them away then in lead boxes or arks, which have then themselves been sealed away in caves, in a site where we know that we have significant remains and we have significant presence of a significant party of people who we know from the Bible regularly cross the Jordan into this area, would suggest that this is definitely Nazarene-type evidence. Obviously, we need to find out a lot more. And another good thing about the announcement of last week is that finally we can get to actually excavate the site, to protect it and defend it against the smugglers, and to find out more and find out for sure who these people were, what they represented, and to find the real story. But we mustn't also forget that in first century Palestine, there wasn't one Judaism. There wasn't one particular belief that was dogmatic to all. That it was full of sects, it was full of differences of opinion, and we get a bit of that from the Gospels themselves when they talk about Pharisees versus Sadducees, and then of course we have Zealots, we have Essenes, and other groups into the bargain. So it's a fairly confused period, and everybody claiming that they represent the true word of God.
All right, let's take our break. While we do that, I encourage you to go check me out at darknessradio.com. If you like what you hear on Coast to Coast, you'll love what you hear on Darkness Radio. We're on Monday through Friday, 9 to midnight, where we explore the strange and supernatural world around us. And I would love for you to join us on that journey. We're based in the Twin Cities on KTLK, the Twin Cities News Talk Station, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. You can listen along live on the iHeartRadio application, or you can find the link right at our website at darknessradio.com. And after our show wraps up, 9 to midnight, you can stay tuned because George Norrie takes over with Coast to Coast AM from midnight till 4 a.m. So you get a double hit of fantastic radio programming from the best in paranormal talk radio to the best in overnight talk radio, all for you at one-stop shop. Go check out darknessradio.com. Click on the Listen Live tab, and you'll find all the information there, plus all of our podcasts and more. And I had announced earlier in the show I'm part of a new project called The Dark Zone. You could check it out at thedarkzone.tv. And there were some issues a little bit earlier. There were so many people overloading the website. It is up and running smoothly. Free subscriptions, memberships. You can go there and find out a lot of great information about the paranormal and all of the other people that I'm working with along on that project, thedarkzone.tv. It's free, it's fun, and it's available. Go check it out for yourself. We'll be back with more and your calls. David Elkington, my guest. You guys are next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back. David Elkington, my guest. We're taking your calls, your emails. Here's a fascinating aspect, too, that was sent in by James. He says, Dave, awesome show. Is there any correlation between the codices and other books that were left out of the modern Christian Bible known as the Apocrypha? And would these codices be considered an addition to the Apocrypha, which seems to reveal more and more with each finding about early Christianity and the faith of earlier followers?
I would think that there is a connection there, definitely. We have definitely got apocryphal type sayings in the codices, as well as canonical sayings from both the Gospels and the Old Testament. So there is an overlap here, and the reason that that's occurred is because, of course, these books are so early that it's very likely they predate the earliest Christian theologies. So we've got to look here at what they truly represent in their ideas of God and the way that that was expressed. And so I think that that's going to be the next historical analytical direction we go in, is to work out precisely what they're saying and how that was interpreted by later Christian fathers in the context of these non-canonical texts.
All right, let's go wild card. Line one, we have Mike in Glasgow, Montana. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Good evening, gentlemen. Dave, I wanted to ask, I was looking at online at some pictures, trying to get a better picture of the plate of Christ, and I just saw a plate that very much looks like a copy or something very similar to what a coin that was minted during... right at the death, I guess you could say, of Alexander the Great. It has a profile of a man wearing a headdress with a horn, and that particular coin is referred to as the Horn of Ammon. I was wondering if you could comment.
Yeah, definitely. We've dealt mostly with lead books and lead scrolls, and obviously our battle has been to authenticate these items and to work out, you know, whether they are the real McCoy or not, and then go forward from there. But however, allied to them, there are also copper and bronze codices too, and some leather ones into the bargain, which we haven't had access to. The image you're referring to was part of a codex, a low-resolution version of which was sent to Dr. Toneman back in 2010. So it's difficult to assess. I mean, the problem is that the Greek text that Toneman said was actually fake, it was a copy, it now turns out that some of the lead books, which have been authenticated, also contain the same passage. So therefore, the books themselves may therefore predate the era that Toneman is talking about, thus showing that he was quite wrong. But the curious thing is, therefore, what is the context of these copper books? At the moment, it's very, very difficult to give an opinion. But if you carry on following this on the Jordan Codices Facebook page, there will be regular updates from this moment onwards, and we'd be very glad to ask any further questions you have in the light of further information coming to light.
All right. Thank you for calling in and sharing that. Here's a quick question to throw from the email. There's not been much mention of Christian Orthodoxy, only Catholic. Is there opinion from the Antiochian Patriarch?
We've been in touch with both the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, as well as, of course, the Church of England. And we've had opinions expressed by the Church of England and also by the Catholic Church. We've had a blessing from the Catholic Church. Obviously, that's a very lovely thing to receive. We're still waiting to hear back from the Orthodox Church on this, but we very much appreciate any contact they could make, because we feel that discussion between all parties about the relevance and the importance of the codices would be very important for the wider world, particularly now in terms of waking up and provoking a greater debate about Christian origins and making more people aware about the nature of Christ's words and his achievement.
All right, wild card line two, Carol, Roxboro, North Carolina. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'd like to ask if there's any example of a name of a person or place or a description of an event or belief that is a new item of information that's unique to the codices and not found in other currently existing Christian biblical references.
Great point. Thank you, Carol. Yeah, what about that? Is there anything brand new, any reference that we have not heard of before?
Yeah, there are, some of which I'm not at liberty to speak about, but we do have the names of Jesus written upon the codices, which was information given us to by an early scholar on the team back in 2007-2008. And we also have the names of some of the apostles, James, Peter, and John, on the codices too. And again, going back to some of the other codices we haven't seen, particularly the copper ones, we have got images of the central part of Jerusalem, believe it or not, sort of early kind of maps or cartographic references that talk about the tombs of David and Solomon and the temple and its whereabouts. And they seem to be referring to Calvary and other such things as well. So there is an awful lot more to come to light. And as I say, we hope to be publishing soon on that particular issue.
All right, let's go to Wildcard Line 3, Jay in Florida. Welcome to Coast AM.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Okay, I don't know if you wanted me to do this one at a time or get it all out.
Well, why don't you start with the first question. We'll see what we can go from there on there for you.
Okay, I was wondering, there's a lot of debate, for one, whether Paul was actually, really Satan's pawn and involved with Constantine and some of the others for actually corrupting Christianity and bringing all the pagan elements into it. I wondered if that shed any light on it. And specifically with the tribulation and rapture time period, and if it revealed if there'd be like a pre, mid, or post. So I'll stop there for now.
It's a very good question, particularly in terms of where we are today and the upheaval around the world and the increasing polarization of opinion, both politically and socially. In terms of Paul, I would suggest that actually he's a controversial figure in the rise of Christianity, of course. But I would suggest that actually that he's not somebody who would have allied himself to the Romans willingly, from what I know. But of course, the Emperor Constantine comes almost 300 years later. And he was, of course, the man who began to create a more centralized Christian church throughout the empire by accepting Christianity. So in a sense, you know, you could say that the shape of modern Christianity takes shape when Constantine finally acknowledges it and finally people can be open in their faith and in their belief. But in terms of the reference to the rapture and the end times, I think we have to sort of look at that in biblical terms and look at it from the point of view of what it actually meant to people in the first century, which I think would be very different in terms of interpretation to what we think today. Today, we're much more literal in our approach, but I think that in the first century, rabbis like Jesus and some of the apostles would have seen this in more symbolic context, and that is precisely what we have on the codices.
Let's go to the international caller line. James in St. Thomas, Canada, welcome to Coast AM.
Yes, thank you very much. Thanks for having
thank
me. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. I think that I'm not saying either way these codex are completely true or not. I just want to read you a scripture from Matthew 24, 26-27. It says, "Therefore, if they say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, and believe it not. For as the lightning cometh from out of the east and shineth on the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be." And the point I'm making, I think, is that I think especially in this point of time, in this age right now, I think we got to be very careful as to what we're searching for, and that maybe we should just stay to what the Bible says. And if anything really does line up with the Bible, I think that really is the truth. And that's my comment. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much for the reference. The problem is that you've got to consider that the Bible itself has been retranslated and re-edited over the years. And if you go to your bookshop, you'll find that there are many versions of the Bible that you can purchase, from the King James Bible through to the Revised English Version to the Jerusalem Bible. You have to be quite careful in terms of what you're reading, and be aware of the fact that if you look at the Bible from the truth perspective, just be very, very careful to understand and appreciate that the truth comes in many colors. But it's a great reference from Matthew, and I'll look it up. The idea of this, the Son of Man coming from out of the desert from what seems to be implied as caves, is very curious. Thank you very much.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in. East of the Rockies, Michael in Norfolk, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we've just got a few minutes, so be quick in your question here.
Okay, I'll be very quick.
Thank you.
There is a Messianic synagogue in Norfolk, Virginia. I'm actually calling from Virginia Beach, as I usually do. But the last time I talked to David, I did call from Norfolk. Now, this synagogue, Beth Messiah, Congregation Beth Messiah in Norfolk, has a rabbi, Rosenfarb, who is, I've talked to him, I've questioned him, and I think the gist of what your controversy is, David, and I talked to you about this before, I think the gist is that these codices show that the original Christians were overly Jewish for today's Christians. And if you know Sid Roth, It's Supernatural, he is connected with Rabbi Rosenfarb in Norfolk. You should get them on, David, and we should talk about this because Herbert W. Armstrong was not a Jew, but he conducted his services like these rabbis, and that's going to change the world.
All right. Thank you, Michael. Did you want to weigh in on any of that, David?
Yeah, that's a very astute observation. I mean, we mustn't forget that Jesus was Jewish. He came from a Jewish milieu in the first century. Obviously, Judaism wasn't such a refined and centralized religion at that period. As I said earlier on, there were many versions, many sects, and of course, Christianity emerged from out of Judaism in that sense, or Hebrewism, to be more accurate. So that's a really good point, and we mustn't forget that. It's a very intrinsic point, a very important one. So if the gentleman would like to get in touch with us through the Jordan Codices Facebook page, again, we'd like to discuss.
We have roughly about a minute and a half left together, David. What do you really hope that's going to come from this research, and are you excited that there are still more miracles that are about to be announced from this find?
You know what? The biggest miracle of all is the survival of these books and the emergence of the face of Jesus from out of those caves in Jordan. And what I'm really hoping for is to link hands between universities in Jordan, the University of Yarmouk in particular, with British and American universities, so we can get young people over to that cave site, which is very, very extensive, and excavate, and everybody join hands from all religions, from all races, and so we can get together, create a proper debate, and help to actually drive people towards a more appreciable understanding and knowledge of these affairs, both historic and theological, so that we can then take the fundamentalists and back them into a corner with our newfound knowledge. And that way, we can then go forward with a greater sense of debate and with a greater sense of confidence and actually give the Jordanians the acclaim that they need for this extraordinary site and the way in which they've sought to protect it, to analyze it, and the way in which they've worked with us. It has been quite amazing.
I thank you very much for your time tonight, David. Please, as more comes out, reach out to us, let us know so that we can continue to educate our listeners around the world on this topic.
Dave, I'd like to say thanks very much indeed to the Coast to Coast team, and I'd like to say a really big thanks to your listeners. And please, all of you, please do stay in touch. We will actually be announcing more of this on our page and elsewhere. And if they have any questions, please do get in touch.
Will do. Stay tuned, kids. When we return, we're going on the quest for the Lost Ark of the Covenant. Graham Phillips next. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.